Oh, I think I'm going to change mics on mine, use my extra specials.
Are we on the air so they at least know we're here?
Yes.
I don't think they can hear me, though.
Now?
Hello, hello. Yes, we are. This is Radio Misteriosa.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Misterioso.
To get the nice microphone going. It's Radio Misterioso. We're here today with my friend and many-time co-host, Walter Bosley. He's got a book, a new book that was just released, what, like 3 days ago? 4 days ago. Last week.
Last Thursday night.
Called...
Empire of
the
Wheel,
yes.
Subtitled Espionage, the Occult, and Murder in Southern California.
You better say it again because
okay.
Your mic was either down or you got to. You.
That's Empire of the Wheel.
There we go.
Espionage, the Occult, and Murder in Southern California, written with Richard B. Spence.
Who are we are going to call presently. Walter has been on the show for many, like the first show you're on, I think was in 2002 or 3 or something with me.
4, because we met in 2004 at the
Adventures Unlimited conference in Kempton, Illinois.
In Kempton, Illinois, yeah.
Where Ken Thomas was speaking.
That's the same year I met Joseph Farrell.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Way back then. Who will be on the show within the next month or so. Whoa, this has a bad connection. We've also talked about Walter's other books on the show. Well, we haven't really talked about Secret of the Amazon Queen, but Latitude 33 definitely because
we kind of conceived the idea on this show.
Yeah, and then of course a couple weeks ago we discussed I Will See You in Time, which is basically a fictionalized version using many of the elements from Empire of the Wheel. So let's call. Richard is not hooked into the board yet. So I can, we can either play music or you can, do you want to give sort of a, or do you want Richard to hear when you're doing the, my first question, which you can see there was what's the basic story idea of the
basic
book?
Story
what are, if somebody said, what's the book about? What would you tell them? And
oh
I will
boy,
call Richard right now.
Okay. While you're dialing, I'll kind of give that intro. Usually, I'll do my preface as you're dialing Richard. I'm usually on here and I'm, you know, goofing around. I like to keep a good sense of humor, regardless of what we're talking about, especially if we're talking about my stuff. Sometimes elsewhere, that sense of humor during the conversation has been mistaken, for a lack of veracity, I guess. Is that the right word? Because some people expect you to be very grim and serious when you're talking about certain strange paranormal anomalous things. And, you know, to that I say, okay, that's your choice. But I will say that where this subject is concerned, the subject of this book, I am going to be serious, more serious than usual, because the nature of it is such that it's no laughing matter. We are talking about serial murder of seven people, three of them children. And I would like everybody listening, and particularly everybody who reads the book, to remember that first and foremostly, this book is, Rick and I consider it a true crime book first, okay? There's some esoteric stuff going on here, and you're going to hear about it tonight, and it's when you read the book, wow. But always keep in mind that we approach it as a true crime book first. And the esoterica that's involved, we personally see as associated with the motive of the killer or killers. In other words, and you'll hear us say it more than once, you don't have to believe, and we're not trying to convince you to believe in the esoteric principles that we talk about and that we point out are associated with this. What we're arguing is that we postulate that the perpetrator or perpetrators believed in these principles, and this is why they did what they did.
There we go.
Do we have Rick on?
We have Richard Spence here on the line with us. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, there we go.
There he is.
I just got to make sure it's coming through the board right here. Let me crank you up a little bit there. There we go.
Okay.
Good. Now you're coming in nice and clear and loud. For those who don't know, Richard Spence has also authored about, I think, something like four or five other books. The last two.
Not that many, but three, not including this one.
I looked online, and the last two, which I think are probably more germane to this discussion and to the book that you worked on with Walter, are Trust No One, which was about a British spy who you might want to discuss a little bit, Sidney Reilly. And the other one, which people listening to the show might know or might have read, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult. What moved you in light of these other books? I mean, maybe you can describe, you know, very quickly what these other two books are, because they've kind of got the same a theme running through them, a similar theme.
Well, somehow or another, and it's one of those things that people ask me, and I'm not sure I can explain. I got sidetracked or directed into espionage in my research some years ago, and probably the first major result of that was the Trust No One book, The Secret World of Sidney Reilly. There are probably a number of people out there who have heard of Sidney Reilly, and I guess if they have, it's probably because they saw the British miniseries that's been broadcast on American PBS many, many times. And that was one of the things that actually got me interested in a topic. Without going too far into that, if you've seen the series, it's entertaining, but in terms of what actually happened, it's pretty much bunkum. And so one of the things that I got interested in was trying to find out who this guy was and what he was up to. And, well, that just branched off into a whole world of its own of intrigue. And I guess the simplest thing to put about it is that Sidney Reilly is often referred to as a model for James Bond. Actually, he wasn't, but he was a model for other things. And as a British spy that you just mentioned. And really, there's nothing much British about him, but he managed to convince some people that he was. I guess that's one of the things to sort of segue into the topic this evening, and the topic of the book, is that I became more and more aware of the fact that things very often, and in fact maybe more often than not, are not what they appear to be. So Sidney Reilly was a person who built an entire career and built a mythos around things that he really wasn't. And then that, the book, the most recent one I did was the one on taking Crowley and examining his career for traces of espionage, and that actually grew out of an article that I'd written some years before that, back around, I think, 1999, 2000. And in that, one of the things that I found, again, just to keep it simple, is There have been a debate for years as to whether or not Crowley's claims to have worked for British intelligence during World War I were just sort of him, you know, blowing hot air and making excuses, or whether there was something to it. And actually, it was when I was doing research on Riley that I just decided to see whether or not there were any files in the old military intelligence division records of the U.S. About Crowley. And sure enough, there was a little file, and there was a document in it, and one of the things it noted was that he had been under investigation by the Americans, but that basically they had been told to lay off because he was an employee of the British government, and the people at the British consulate in New York knew everything that he was doing. And that was sort of the beginning of in many ways, going back. I mean, what I was trying to do, I'm not a Crowley follower. I'm not a follower of his religion, not opposed to it either. Decided just to go back and look at his career from the standpoint of, well, you know, what might he have been doing for British intelligence, and who did he know that was connected to it? And, again, simple explanation, it's all over the place. and it wasn't just, you know, one episode, but it tends to be a kind of, I guess you could say, a leitmotif that runs through his career, really from his days at Cambridge all the way up until World War II. So there are, again, things that often, you know, things are not what they appear to be, and that people's motives can often be quite different than what they may appear. There are lots of agendas which people have, and sometimes they have multiple ones. So that's why when Walter sort of first approached me and, you know, asking me questions about various things, espionage related or others, and, you know, I mean, I knew where San Bernardino was, and I think I'd probably been through there a couple of times, and it wasn't a place that, you know, I associated with anything particularly mysterious, but every place has its own mysteries, and I think this is one that certainly fits there.
Yeah, when you read the book, it becomes obvious that there are things that are going on in communities all the time and have been for many years, and they're all the way from something completely innocent and people playing with each other's husbands and wives to espionage, murder, and beyond. And that's what part of the theme of this book, what's covered in the book. Walter, when I asked you what the book was about, what the story arc of the book was about in the beginning there, did you actually say that? I was talking to Richard and I didn't listen
to
you.
No, what I did was, and I explained to the listeners, I just kind of gave a little preface as to the gravitas of the story for me.
Oh, okay.
And I was kind of, you know, because usually I'm a jovial guy on here, I like to keep a light
sense
of humor.
Okay.
And
I did
just
hear
explaining
that
the nature of what Rick and I have written about is primarily, I mean, it's a crime. It's true crime. I am convinced, you know, we are convinced, and that's what we're postulating here, is that these deaths. But to go into that, essentially,
You can reveal as much as little as you want, but for the purposes of discussing the book and getting people interested in, you say what you need to say. And I may dig and I may not, so we'll see.
Empire of the Wheel, espionage.
By the way, I have read the book for people that are listening.
Oh, thank God. Empire of the Wheel, espionage, the occult, and murder in Southern California is about what we have identified in the book as the San Bernardino working as a theory, an explanation for the mysterious deaths, the curious and questionable deaths of seven individuals in San Bernardino, California, in the valley, in the second half of 1915, the years leading up to America's entry into World War I is about the background of this. And these seven individuals, most of them died within days of each other.
Which is a lot for a little community back then, I would think.
Right. And four of them adults, three of them children. Also, the unexpected, surprising, esoteric, occult details that run rampant through the mystery.
Is that as much as you want to say about the story arc of the book? Actually, that's intriguing enough.
Yeah.
What I know when you did Latitude 33, I know what sparked that interest.
Right.
What was it that kind of said, oh, I think I'd better You know, well, you probably didn't even know you wanted to write about it until things started kind of falling into place.
Yeah, this book particular?
Yeah.
Yeah, in particular. Yeah, right. Yeah, what I was doing was following up in early 2008, excuse me, on the Latitude 33 book, just for fun. What I decided to do was follow the so-called ley lines out of the Disneyland area, and a few of them led towards the Inland Empire, which is where I live. And I was initially just looking for something paranormal, like ghost stories associated allegedly with these ley lines. And that's when I came across the woman named Cora Stanton. She apparently was haunting the Inland Center Mall there for years. And I learned about this from a woman named Ann Walker, who's a librarian out there in the area. And I met with her, and she told me all about the ghost story, and she was the one that first told me about Cora Stanton and how she believed that Cora Stanton was murdered, was allegedly a suicide, but she believed she was murdered. And she told me, you know, go take a look at the newspaper stories, and you'll see all about this. So I did. I followed up. And again, I want to emphasize, at that time, this was still a big fun ghost hunting kind of thing, following up my big fun Disneyland book. So I went to the library, that special collections room, and researched through the old newspapers from 1915. And, of course, I found the Cora Stanton articles. And, indeed, she was this stranger, not from the town, who was found drowned and poisoned in a lake at the park that used to be where the mall is now, a park called Urbita Springs Park. And, you know, just my investigative nature, as I was looking through these articles, I happened to see an article about two children that had died, or the boy, there was a boy and a girl, 4 and 2 years old, and the girl had died and the boy was going to die from eating poison candy. Well, that was the first spark that I took off my let's have fun ghost hunting hat. And my investigator nature took over, because I am a former federal agent.
I should have mentioned this at the beginning for people don't know.
And I'm a licensed private investigator. And that immediately piqued my investigative nature. So the more I looked at this, I found the two children who were poisoned. Of course, the woman, Cora, who they would find out allegedly that her name was Cora Stan. And then I, found a couple weeks later two more victims. A girl who was given a poisoned orange, and a man who allegedly shot himself. And the more I widened the scope on the dates, basically I found that 7 people between August and December of 1915 had all died of under questionable circumstances. 3 of them called suicides, and the children, nobody seemed to follow up on the fact that they were poisoned. Just all sorts of details that are in the book.
I've got a question. Did you check any records of any communities outside of San Bernardino to find out what the average death rates by misadventure or...
Right.
And this was unusual.
Right, this was unusual.
For that time, exactly. 1915.
Exactly. The homicide rate in San Bernardino at that time was not very high, particularly compared to our standards. And what it was is that 7 people dying under these weird, questionable circumstances in this period of time. And most of them, remember, were in November and December. So it was just a matter of within a few weeks, all these people are dying.
Yep.
And that right there, to bring it back to your question, that right there, and I learned all that from my first day. I stayed there for a few hours. And my investigative nature, my gut said, wait a minute, there's something more going on here than just, this one woman's suicide. And that was really when I took off with the research, not intending to write another book for almost a year. I investigated this for almost a year before I decided to write about it. And
yeah, I remember when you were investigating it and telling me I'm finding more and more stuff. And why did you maybe Rick can answer. Why were you contacted, and why did you say yes when Walter said, could you help me out with this book?
Well, the first thing, I think he approached me with the number of questions, procedural questions, and whether or not there were I saw any signs of this or that in it. And, you know, I have to admit that I was, I think Walter can attest to this, I was a little reluctant to get involved. And part of it was because it took me a while to sort of see the picture to it as well. I mean, he'd been looking into this for some time. And so the story when it first came forward is that, well, you know, 1915, San Bernardino, all of these people suddenly dying in the autumn. And, you know, some of my basic questions were pretty much the same as yours. Well, you know, what were the average murder and suicide rates? I mean, how the size of a community was this? What, you know, and as Walter said, actually they're relatively easy to find, but if you look at national murder and suicide rates and you look at the size of the town, they are way off the charts. It doesn't mean that anomalies can't happen, but there's nothing right. That fits to normal. I mean, that's what eventually began to... Yeah, I think initially when it came forward to this, my natural response was to sort of argue that, well, you know, this is unusual, you know, it's a little weird, but is it that weird? I mean, it seems to be, maybe it's all a coincidence. And one of the things that I guess I've learned perhaps later than I should have is that true coincidences are fairly rare things. Most of what pass off as coincidence, and certainly Walter knows this as an investigator, is that they're not. They're usually the consequence of something. But I had to be convinced. And contrary to what some people, even my wife, might think, I'm pretty tough to convince in some cases. I can be a hard sell, and I don't know whether I was a hard sell, but in putting the various pieces together, as Walter revealed the story, and as together we found more little bits and pieces. And you know, I went out and checked and see, you know, what were the national crime statistics? How odd is this? How off the charts would it be? And as things began to add up, I had to admit that this isn't a little weird. It's very weird. And I wasn't at all sure what was going on, but something clearly was. And that, again, sort of set off my hunting instincts on these things. I mean, there was something going on. And, you know, and I'm not, and I don't think that... either of us would argue that we have the whole thing sewn up tight, that we can tell you exactly what happened, who did what. Actually, we can't. We can tell you that there were some very strange things going on in the autumn of 1915 in San Bernardino. And we can then propose a number of possible explanations for them. And some of those explanations probably bear more water than others, but there is an explanation there somewhere, and there was definitely something strange going on. So it's, you know, I think the essential part of it is that you have, one of the things that really struck me is you've got homicides, including, again, the death of a brother and sister, very small children. I think Walter can probably remember exactly what their age is. It's something like 3 and 4?
It's 4 and 2, yeah.
4 and 2.
Right.
You know, small children, which today, would arouse attention. And also, I mean, the size of San Bernardino itself in 1915 was, what, about 12,000?
Yeah, it was about 12,000, right.
Yeah, and if you, the surrounding communities add some thousands more. But keep in mind, we're talking about a town and even a broader community, which is nowhere near the size that it is today. It was a much more, in many ways, intimate environment. And one of the things I can compare that to is that I currently live in a town, I'm not in it right now, but in Idaho, which is somewhat larger than that, but not much larger. And I don't know whether I'd describe Moscow, Idaho as an intimate environment, but it's a relatively small one, and there's not much that tends to happen there that people don't know about. And it's one of those things that, you know, certainly strangers can pass through town unnoticed, but probably not all that often or for any length of time. I mean, it's a different type of environment if we're thinking of large cities or even what, the Inland Empire is today. But one of the things that struck me about it is just the way in which the investigations of these of these deaths were handled, or really in ways in which they weren't handled. Police procedures were different, investigative techniques were different, but really, I think Walter can probably elaborate on this more, but the key death in the case, that of this woman identified as Cora Stanton, and that itself is an interesting story as to how she's identified that way. Here you got a case of where her death is declared a suicide by a local coroner's jury before any real investigation has taken place. And stranger still, there's apparently at least one man on the coroner's jury that isn't even from the local community. So the more you begin to dig into this, all these little, these seeming anomalies or these question marks began to add up.
Do you think because of the atmosphere of the time where people trusted authority, they wanted to get this out of the way as quickly as possible, including the parents of the kids and things and acquaintances of people that had been murdered or were killed or whatever it was? Do you think the atmosphere of the time and the trust of authority and the wish to get it out of the way was a factor, or was this kind of common for people to just die and there not to be any kind of investigation? It does seem weird. I mean, I would start looking into that too.
Well, when you consider that, go back.
What I'm trying to say is it common to just not worry about it when somebody says, it's okay, just because they don't want to deal with it, and not posit that there was some sort of larger conspiracy? I'm playing devil's advocate, which I will be doing throughout this interview. Do you understand what I was saying?
I'm reformulating my. you kind of boggled my head there with the way.
I'm sorry. I'm just saying, is it out of the ordinary for deaths like this to be overlooked because of the
1915,
and
no,
also because of people just trusted authority?
Here's one of the things that I think both Rick and I found a curious fact with this case is that. This woman, who was a stranger in town, a 35-year-old virgin, by the way, that's another interesting aspect that gets into some of those esoteric things, she got more press and seemed to be of more interest to the townspeople than the children. And that struck me as odd. There was a lot more attention paid on her than and somebody who a coroner's jury was quick to determine was just a despondent woman who committed suicide. And I don't mean to downplay the despondent out there, but when you've got that against, clearly in the story it talks about the children, were given poisoned candy, and yet the despondent adult suicide seems to be of more interest to the community than children who are given poison candy, and then later the 14-year-old is given poison orange.
Yeah.
That's kind of
there's a salacious, whatever you want to call it, element to that, rather than children being poisoned and an unattached stranger.
I
think people would be more interested in sex than innocence.
Yeah, well, the fact that she's a virgin indicates that there was no sex going on there.
Right.
She hadn't been sexually assaulted.
At straws. Please continue.
So,
but another very weird thing about, the Cora Stanton case. Again, this isn't that big of a town. It is a railroad town, among other things. So it's not unusual to have people passing through. Have accommodations for them. Now, keep in mind, this woman is, she isn't what we would today call a vagrant or a typical vagrant. She has fairly good clothes. Her hands don't show any sign of having done hard work. Again, late 20s, early 30s. But no one, with one exception, no one in town knows who this woman is or even remembers seeing her. It's as if she's virtually invisible. And the only person who comes forward to say that, I ran into this woman before, probably the afternoon before she died later that evening, is a receptionist in a doctor's office where this woman just walks in, comes in, has to see the doctor, seems a bit agitated, eventually makes a sort of interesting comment about he's not here. sort of muttering to herself, and then leaves. That's it. No one else. I mean, there's no presumably these would have been investigated. She didn't pay lodging anywhere. She didn't eat anywhere. I mean, no one. It's as if she's, with that one exception, she was sort of invisible. And that's, you know, that could happen. You know, people can sort of fall through the cracks, but you would think that someone would come forward to do this. The one person, we might get into this later, I don't want to mention it now, who will actually show up, the one who comes in and confirms or tries to confirm her identity as Cora Stanton, an identity that I find dubious for this reason, also turns out to be a kind of phantom. That's another thing. This fellow Thomas Cavanaugh, who will show up and say he's going to identify the body, but then, of course, can't identify the body. I'm not quite sure how that works. And says, "Oh yeah, I knew who she was." And I think he says he knew her brother.
Huh.
I think they were from Iowa. And yet this guy doesn't. You know, he's sort of there and then he's gone. He can't, identify the body, and he doesn't seem to exist either. The information he gives himself about himself is false. That also is very strange. And nobody knows him. He's not even a local person. He's just this guy who suddenly appears and disappears, and seems not to exist at all. And I think, as Walter mentioned, Cora Stanton becomes this kind of big deal in San Bernardino.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not only does she get a lot of press, I mean, I think we found articles about her when she's identified there, and there must have been APBs or some messages that went out. As far as papers as far away as Salt Lake City carry that, that the dead woman that was found in San Bernardino has now been identified, although there's no one else comes up to confirm that
identity.
There is no, and we looked through census records to see whether or not there was a Cora Stanton that could have been. She's not there. I mean, there are lots of Cora Stantons. That's a surprisingly commonplace name, but when you narrow it down by age and by race and locale, there aren't that many.
Right.
The only woman really in terms, I think, of age that we could find that fit her was a kind of school marm from Massachusetts who sort of shows up in the 1910 census, I think, and then is gone thereafter. But other than that, Cora Stanton, as described, doesn't exist either.
Right.
Yeah, well, another question I had was there were this spate of murders, and nobody had really said anything about it or connected them, not even the authorities at the time, before you two happened on it?
Exactly when you read the newspaper accounts, and this is what astonished me when I first started investigating this, was that there appeared to be no connection whatsoever to Cora Stanton, who she was found drowned in the lake.
You might have to back up, Walter. It's feeding back, and for some reason, or you have to talk right onto the top of the microphone.
Okay, she was found drowned in the lake with poison in her stomach.
A little better. Yeah, thanks.
And shortly before, just a few days before she was found, the little girl died of a poison given to her in candy. The poison was never identified. They attempted to with a lab, and it could not be identified. And then her brother, who also ate the same candy, died just shortly after they found the woman, the mysterious red-haired woman, who would be named Cora Stanton. And then also you have in December, around December 2nd, I believe, you have Orta Hedges. The two children were named Willie and Eileen Estep. I like to put names on these people so that you realize we're not just talking about a symbol here, a cipher. And then little Orta Hedges, she was 14 years old. She was given a poisoned orange, and the lab could not identify that poison either at all. Now, you got to remember, in the early 20th century, around that era, murder by poison, chemistry was advanced enough to where they pretty much knew what the poisons were, and murder by poison was very popular. So the idea that they had come across a poison that a crime lab, pharmaceutical lab, what have you, could not identify is something we go into in the book.
How did they know it was a poison if they couldn't identify it as a poison?
They found a substance. You know, they knew it was toxic. It was the only, and they found it because they pinpointed what she ate that the rest of her family did not eat. And they found this substance in an orange.
Oh, okay, okay.
And yet, you have these three children who died by being given, you know, poisoned edibles. And you have this woman who's found. Now, her poison was identified. It was bichloride of mercury is what they found in her stomach. But still, you have four people poisoned and who died under these mysterious circumstances. And yet, there was never any talk that there was any killer on the loose or that these were tied in any way. So this was something that I believe Rick and I are the first two to, since 1915, to discuss this publicly. It seems to have been forgotten by San Bernardino.
Okay, so then we've established that there was a series of murders, seven people.
Series of deaths.
Deaths.
Mysterious questionable deaths.
In a short period of time, especially for that period,
right,
in that small community. What? How did you go further with this? Maybe we can get into some of the what led you to, what theories you had and what led you to them, and how that blossomed into other things.
Well, I began to look at the, and this is what, this is the factor that led me to the point where I went to Rick. I began to look at the dates of the deaths. I'm very analytical in what I do, and so naturally I said, well, let's look at the dates. Let's look at, you know, it's kind of the process that we've discussed with our a good friend of ours, the idea of broken symmetry, where you just jump in the middle of something and you just start looking, and then you go backwards and forwards. And I began to see, I found a pattern with dates, and that's what led me to Hecate, the goddess Hecate. And that was really when the floodgate of the esoteric symbolism in all this really started flowing. And at the same time I was doing this, I happened across Rick's book, Secret Agent 666. So I started perusing it in the bookstore, and I was astonished when I discovered that Aleister Crowley, in 1915, the fall of 1915, had gone on a tour, you might say, of the United States, starting in New York, going through Detroit, Chicago, and dipping into Canada, and going through Seattle down to San Francisco and into California down to San Diego. And then the next place he turns up is on his way to the Grand Canyon. Now, I thought, wow, Aleister Crowley and everything he represents, he's in California at the time this is going on in 1915. How curious is that?
Well, surely there were lots of people in Southern California at that time that had bad juju associated
with
them.
Greg, at any given time, there's a lot of people anywhere. But the point is, we're talking Aleister Crowley. And
okay.
So naturally, not all of those people are Aleister Crowley,
right,
no matter how, you know, whatever they're into. I mean, Aleister Crowley.
Yes, I didn't let you finish, so please go ahead.
So, you know, I thought, well, how interesting is this? And I went to, at that point, I believe, is about the time I contacted Rick, told him who I was, what I was researching, and, you know, might he find this interesting? You know, I was thinking this might fill a hole in Crowley's itinerary,
right,
while he's in California. Now, admittedly, what I knew about Crowley was about what most people purport to know. And my knowledge of, and my opinion of Aleister Crowley has altered considerably in the research and writing of this book. But to bring it back to San Bernardino, eventually in my research, I wanted to know, was Crowley in San Bernardino in the fall of 1915? And in all honesty, I wanted to know if he was there on the days either the children were poisoned or any of this bad stuff happened.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered by going to the Santa Fe Railroad Museum and researching their records, is I found out that indeed Crowley would have had to have been in San Bernardino during this season. However, through Rick's research in his own diaries and through the great help of Scott Moody, our contributing editor, who I want to it's interesting. I want to talk about him a little bit more later because he did the same thing for Adam Gorightly's Shadow Over Santa Susana book, the excellent Charles Manson book. And,
yes.
And Scott is our editor, and he's going to be doing something really cool with this book and its printed edition for us. But Scott Moody went to his sources on Crowley, and we were able to determine that when Crowley passed through there, it would have had to have been earlier than not on the right days to be involved with any of this. And of course,
but before the first murder or the first mysterious death happened,
in between them. Okay. In other words, he was accountable to other places when they started.
Right.
And then when he passed through, nothing happened. And then the other things happened after he had passed through.
Yeah. From what I remember the book, there's no record of him passing through, but he had to because of the way the trains were set up.
Exactly. Because of the Mexican War. See, the Mexican War was causing all passenger rail traffic going from east to west in the United States in the southern half of the country. If you were going to the east from California, you had to, on a train, you had to go through San Bernardino. Because it was the major rail hub, and there was no passenger traffic allowed south in southern Arizona, New Mexico,
okay,
and,
yeah,
and such. So we pretty much proved that Crowley had to be in San Bernardino at the time. Crowley.
Yeah, he was in San. Went to he was in L.A. Then he went to San Diego. San Diego was sort of his furthest reach in the U.S. And then I mean, actually, when I was working on the Secret Agent 666 book. He's very, you know, sometimes he will describe his locations in some detail. Other times he just sort of, you know, glosses over them. But he was in San Diego, and then he mentions that his next stop was the Grand Canyon. So the question is, well, how do you get from San Diego to the Grand Canyon? First thing that I did was to look at a map, and I said, and he also mentions visiting Tijuana. So that, which he would not pass up. He don't like it. But
who would?
So there was a rail line that went along through Mexico and came up, and looking at the map, that seemed to be the way that he would go. And that was my first assumption. But then I later found out, this is where you always need to look further, that because of the Mexican, as Walter noted, because of the Mexican Civil War, which was going on, that line was inoperable. So the only way you could get from San Diego to the Grand Canyon, which you had to get on the train and you had to go back north, and that would take you straight through San Bernardino. So whether he was in San Bernardino for a day or whether he was there for an hour, he passed through the place, and he was there, I think we forget, he leaves, we can get this in the book, we've got the days down, but he's there, I think, about 4 days, 3 or 4 days before Cora Stanton is found dead. So you can't put, you know, so there's no way he could have killed Cora Stanton. Doesn't mean that they didn't arrive on the same train, since we don't know, and it's not saying that they did, how long she was there before. It's one of those things that, you know, I think that it's interesting, and I think and it's one of those things, again, that I'm inclined to think is not altogether a coincidence. On the other hand, I don't want to press the idea that that's what the book is about and that somehow this all centers around Aleister Crowley.
Right,
it doesn't.
Right.
It is a murder mystery, a true crime in and of itself that really doesn't require his presence. But his presence is yet another weird element that fits into a lot of other ones. And I think that's one of the things that the book is just the layering of things that could be added onto this case.
Yeah, well, what are some of these other things that were going on that you found out? I mean, there's apparently some sort of homegrown occult connection that you may have uncovered.
Well, yes, when you look at the esoterica, I'll call it, that pops up, and you look around at the possible players. And that's another thing the book does, not to jump onto that and forget about the espionage angle, because as the book explains, there was reason to wonder if some of these deaths didn't have something to do with the espionage activity that was going on in California at the time. Now, you guys, most of the listeners of this show and Greg know my background, you know, in counterintelligence.
Yeah, I did find this part kind of fascinating. It connects to a lot of other things through Germany, India.
I did not know about the German Hindu conspiracy that was a very active thing in California during the World War I eras. And basically, in a nutshell, you had the Germans had a good reason to be involved with India, because India was rebelling, you know, in their early rebellion against England at that time, and Germany was in a war with England. So, you know, they had a common enemy.
Friend of my enemy, yeah.
And Germany was shipping arms up through the Gulf of Mexico, across North America, both in the United States and Mexico, to San Diego, from where they were smuggling these weapons across the Pacific to Burma to be handed over to the East Indians, to India, the revolutionaries there. And, of course, with such activity, you're going to have your people there kind of overseeing it. And you're going to have your intelligence agents there facilitating things. So if you're going to have German and, Indian agents, East Indian agents in California, you're going to have British agents there watching them, too. So there was quite a bit of intelligence and espionage activity going on in California. At the time when this thing broke, the Annie Larson affair was really one of the big last straws, so to speak, when they caught them shipping these weapons out of San Diego to Burma. It kind of uncovered a lot of stuff with this German Hindu conspiracy and the trial that went on, the spy trial, so to speak, was the most expensive and biggest court trial in United States history up until the O.J. Simpson trial.
When did this take place?
In 1916, I believe, is when the trial actually happened, 16 or 17, I think.
Yeah. I think it's early 1917.
Yeah, in 1917.
Okay.
Somewhere in that.
Well,
it goes on for...
Right. Does this German Hindu conspiracy impinge on... Or how did you describe it as impinging on that?
On the mystery.
Or be connected to your mystery?
We had to look at the possible perpetrators of... for instance, you had this mysterious woman who would be identified as Cora Stanton. Well, was she an intelligence agent? You know, that was what... she had gone into the dentist's office. Rick was describing earlier the reception as... in the doctor's office,
yes,
that had recognized her.
The only one
her,
that identified her.
Recognized her from the day before.
Yeah.
And she had gone in and she had made an enigmatic comment about who is a liar, he is not here, as if she was waiting for someone. Or maybe she was talking about the doctor. It was very enigmatic and very vague. And because she was a stranger and because she was appeared to be in good health, again, as Rick described earlier, she's in her early 30s. Her hands show no sign of being a working class woman. She's described as being about, 5 feet tall and 135, 140 pounds. So she's not starving.
Yeah.
And her clothing. Well, this is what's interesting. Her clothing is nice clothing. It's not raggedy. And all the labels of the clothing are either removed or scratched out.
When she is found.
When she is found. So this, in my mind, and in Rick's mind as well, this maybe she was working undercover.
Yeah, the first thing people would ask would be, well, she went to the doctor. Maybe she wasn't feeling well, and then she died from
poison
from whatever,
in her stomach,
or had poison. But the thing is that the coroner determined, and she was found in a lake, basically sort of drowned and poisoned at the same time. And the time of death was put at like something like midnight or 1 a.m. or something like that.
Which
is a very weird time to be running around and not really abandoned, but a closed and not inhabited park.
And it was the drowning that killed her.
Yeah,
and the poison was in her stomach, bichloride of mercury, and the only other marks, the only possible sign of a struggle was there was a bruise on one of her ankles and her upper leg. Now that could have happened, from a fall or at any time before the death, or it could have been related to the death. And that's one of the unfortunate things about the fact that the only existing record of all this, remember, are the newspaper accounts, the police records. From what I was told by the San Bernardino Police Department, the police records prior to 1930 no longer exist. So we don't – and I'd like to throw this in here too. A lot of times, like you had asked me if it was going to be narrative nonfiction, the book. And, yeah. And I think a lot of people expect pat answers. This is a book of questions. There was no file for us to refer to. There was nobody caught for this. This was not a closed case so that we could go back like Capote could do with In Cold Blood,
right.
Or Eric Larson could do with Devil in the White City, where there's all the details and they knew who did it and they talked to them and caught them and everything. This is a mystery from the word go. And there are no answers. There were no answers left.
No definitive ones, but you've got ones that you think might explain some. Did you find any background on Cora Stanton to indicate that she might have been involved in some sort of espionage or what her background was?
It's more association by the fact that they did use the Brits were using female agents at that time, I found, in the United States. And the fact that she was, you know, just a stranger, nobody knew, the mysterious Thomas Cavanaugh, who appeared in town for a day, just a few hours, long enough to say who she was and vouch for the suicide note that was suddenly found. These are suspicious to, you know,
right,
to
meaning
anyone.
There's something going on rather than some strange woman just coming
And when you know you have spy activity going on, you know, espionage going on all around you, you know, you kind of have to take a look at that. The problem with the espionage solution, so to speak, the spy solution, is the deaths of the children. And we explain in the book why,
right.
You know, that espionage would not likely be the answer to the mystery of these potential murders. But it was certainly going on in the area, and some of the players might have been involved,
right.
Certainly, some of the adult players in
right.
espionage.
So what else was going on in the area that you two uncovered that would explain or involve these deaths of these, what is it, three children, the brother and sister and the one other child?
The brother and sister and one other child. Well, it's interesting. San Bernardino is the home, the first spiritualist temple in California. Was this temple founded in San Bernardino in the late 1800s. And the temple still existed at the time. And what was very interesting, what led me down that path, was that Walter Franklin Prince was the rector of the Episcopal Church in San Bernardino during this mystery. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Houdini drama will recognize both the spiritualists and Walter Franklin Prince, because Walter Franklin Prince was the man who was running the American Psychical Research Association, whom Houdini was working with in his investigations against the corrupt spiritualists in the next decade.
Good thing I brought the water. Sorry, Walter.
Good Lord.
Oh, there's another little detail. Guess who else was someone who, in addition to Houdini and Prince, who absolutely detested spiritualists?
Right.
Aleister Crowley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, that's, again, one of those things that...
I think that's one of the reasons he went to San Diego to kind of put a lid on, what's her name, Catherine Tingley, maybe?
Well, you know, that's... Again, I don't know. I think Crowley in his confessions, his sort of version of an autobiography, just to show how little things can connect. Crowley mentions being in Los Angeles, and one of the few things he mentions about it is that, one, he thought it was overrun with, I think he calls, you know, faux occultists or something to that effect, or semi-occultists. He doesn't seem to think too much of them.
Yeah.
But then he also mentions going for a hike in the hills north of town. Those are
Griffith
the Hollywood
Park.
Hills.
Yeah, where Griffith Park is now.
Right, and guess what? In 1915, the Hollywood Hills, they were it's not built up as it is today. One of the things, really prominent features there, was a thing called the Crotona Colony.
Yes.
The Crotona Colony was a theosophist colony. Not exactly spiritualists, but he didn't care much for them either. And the Crotona theosophist colony was loyal to a female leader by the name of Annie Besant. And Annie Besant, among many other things, was an outspoken proponent of Indian independence and was suspected by the British government of conniving with the Germans and Indian seditionists.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. Yeah.
So, you know, that's one of the places where these weird little espionage angles come in. And then, as you note, not long after that, I mean, immediately after leaving Los Angeles, Crowley makes a beeline for Catherine Tingley's rival. She's the rival to Besant, the Osovist outfit at Point Loma.
Yeah.
So his connections, his visitations to these places have, you know, they may be sort of multitasking, but they don't, they have a particular agenda to them. Because one of the other things, going back to something we mentioned before about the of Cora Stanton's death in the lake and the labels being removed from her clothes, I remember that was one of the things that struck me.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a major issue, but okay, here's someone who's going, you have to think about it. I'm going to drown myself in the lake, but then I'm also going to poison myself, and I'm going to cut the labels out of my clothes. Now, I guess if a pair of scissors and the labels had been found, you know, near the edge of the lake, that might make sense. But they're not, because nobody knows where she was until she's, I mean, she's the invisible woman, basically, until she's found in that. But that, I mean, who would do that? I mean, people engage in any number of sort of odd, you know, you can say that drowning yourself is aberrant behavior. But cutting the labels out of your clothes before you do it, and then poisoning yourself, apparently for good measure, or appearing to poison yourself, those are things that just don't fit together.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Is that an MO for getting rid of somebody in the intelligence? Because it sounds like something that somebody who is familiar with investigative techniques would do.
Well, it's just because it's suspicious. It looked to me, someone who's been an agent and been in operations and intel operations, it looked to me like she was someone working undercover, who possibly was working undercover and just didn't want to be identified, or her killer felt that those labels might identify him in some way. That's another possibility we go into in the book. Add something that if people aren't the listener's not convinced about, you know, why this woman is so mysterious and why her death. For the first several days after she's found, you remember, nobody knows who she is. There's no name. There's nothing. She's just a complete, you know, blank. She's just found in the lake. Thousands of people in the city are marched past her in the morgue, and nobody knows who she is except this receptionist that says, yeah, she was in the day before that she was found dead. Now, the newspapers more than once repeat this little interesting fact, and they do it this way. They say, there's no hat, no lady's purse, no suicide note. And it's reported more than once. There's no hat, lady's hat, there's no purse, there's no suicide note. When they finally do identify her, what do you think is found? A lady's hat, a purse, and a suicide note. And what's interesting is they're found under a bush, within the search perimeter that had already been done twice.
Right.
Sounds like the
bullet 399 too.
Yeah, and the suicide note is very plain. Says, "I am Cora Stanton." Basically says she is sick and out of work. You know, I give myself to my God. I came here from El Paso.
El Paso.
And what was interesting about that is El Paso itself was a town where there was a lot of spy activity. And there's probably reason to suspect, at least, if not believe, at this point, that some of this smuggling of these weapons could have gone through El Paso, to get it onto the train, perhaps. So there she's tied with another city that has, you know, kind of a past thematically with what's going on in espionage. So then she's found with these labels scratched out. She's a stranger, you know, Crowley, who... It isn't involved with intel. You know, he had passed through town, so there's all that. So there was a lot of reason to believe, as we say in the counterintelligence investigative world, to look into her, to suspect that maybe she was one of these intel players. But we were mentioning before, you know, Crowley going down to Point Loma, and the other part of Crowley's role in this wasn't so much, again, that this is a big Aleister Crowley thing, but his itinerary led me and us, as we wrote this book together, to look at another esoteric aspect, or one of the main esoteric aspects of what we postulate the perpetrators were doing. And that brings us to the telluric currents. Crowley's itinerary from New York across the U.S. down to California and up through San Bernardino took him through cities and areas where our consultant, our source for telluric current, or commonly referred to sometimes as ley lines, where he passed through, there's ley energy, telluric currents, and major nodal points. And the book really gets into that as well.
Okay, this is where a lot of people reading the book will go, what does ley lines have to do with anything? And the point of fact that you have to accept that there is such a thing, and that they're well, for most people, they don't even know what
actually,
they are.
Actually,
Walter.
You don't have to accept, and that's what Rick and I say in the book. Is that well? Let me jump in and explain the concept here. Now, there is such a thing as telluric current. That is a scientific fact. This is it's an ELF, extremely low frequency energy, that runs through the terrain of the Earth, okay? Because the Earth is a big electromagnetic ball, among other things. Now, these telluric currents have been known by radio engineers, you know, for years. Since the 1850s, telluric currents have been used, tapped into, for telegraphy. In the early 1900s, early 20th century, the U.S. Navy tapped into telluric currents to use in things like ground radio and such. And this is some of the energy that guys like Nikola Tesla would tap into, and John Worrell Keeley, and later, you know, Victor Schauberger and stuff. So this is, telluric currents are a real thing. Now, we agreed in this book that basically what people commonly refer to as ley line energy is probably this telluric current. Okay? Now, we know that I've written a book about, you know, ley lines in an interesting place, and some of the wilder things and ideas that can be done with them and on them. So there are a lot of people, as we know by the numerous books that are published on the issue, that, you know, believe certain things, have accepted certain things about this ley energy.
Oh, so what's wrong with this microphone? So what you're talking about is your characters, or some of them, being aware of this. So whether you or I, quote unquote, believe in it or not, it's an element in the story, used by the players in the story.
I prefer to say players in the case, because story is too much of a word connected with fiction. These deaths happened, and exactly. That's what we say in the book, is that if supposing these were murders, the perpetrator or perpetrators, they were doing this on these ley lines and on these intersections of ley lines in order to use, theoretically, sympathetic magic or to infuse, for whatever purpose they were doing, to infuse the area with this energy.
Okay, here's a question. Do you know of any examples of anybody in the theosophical movement, the spiritualist movement, any people that are in your groups, that are in your book, that were aware of these things and utilized them, or at least knew about them in some way?
Well, we have quotes in the book. We go into that. Tingley herself, Blavatsky, Madame right. Blavatsky, commented about this kind of thing in her writings. Crowley himself. I'm personally convinced, Rick, I don't know where you are in this yet, but I'm personally convinced that what happened...
I'm kind of convinced, but not totally. But that doesn't matter.
But what happened... I'm convinced that what happened in San Bernardino very likely inspired Crowley's Moonchild novel, because it was, even though it wasn't published until 11 or so years after this, it was written within 18 months of Crowley going through San Bernardino in California. And he talks about it in there.
Okay. How would that connect to your story?
Well, in the plot of Moon...
Your plot.
No, it's not a plot. The case.
Your case.
You're using fiction terms.
I'm sorry.
That's making me shudder. In our case, in this book, okay, Crowley, in Moonchild, his characters, there's a dark cult and a light cult, a good cult, and the evil cult, so to speak, is sanctioning murder on certain particular geographical spots to infuse to draw the energy and to use that energy of the traumatic death of the victim.
Right, right.
Very much like sacrificial murder or human sacrifices like the Aztecs did.
Yeah, or what he did, demonstrably sex magic, which is using a completely different act.
Right, yeah. And this is something I'd like to emphasize that, you know, in this research, I'm convinced that Crowley would have found this abhorrent. I mean, this is not, and again, it's not all about Crowley, this book, but,
right.
You know, I do want to emphasize.
But he is a player.
Yeah, he is.
He's one of the persons of interest.
And we call him an incidental in the criminal investigation world.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, you know, there's any guilt there.
Another thing that could be added about Moonchild is that the two conflicting groups of magicians, the two battling groups of occultists, one, the one which the Crowley character sort of himself is aligned with, they are the white magicians. They're on the and this is all the action in that book takes place just before World War One.
Right.
But one of the things that becomes clear is that the good magicians are aligned with who? The Allies.
Right. Of course.
And the evil magicians are aligned with
Axis.
The Germans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now that gets that's Crowley the compulsive patriotic Englishman perhaps putting that in there. But if there's any I've run across other things where he works elements of as many writer does it, puts elements of real things into the fiction that he would write. His Simon If stories, his sort of take on the Sherlock Holmes story, which are pretty interesting.
Yeah,
have all kinds of little details and real characters added into them. So this isn't to argue that, you know, I'm by no means convinced that Moonchild is telling a true story. On the other hand, I'm willing to accept that it may have been influenced by actual events, because as Walter noted, this was something he was going to be writing just within a year and a half after these events. So they were very much on his mind at the time.
Other elements of the story, too, that are clearly inspired by other events in his life. That's a matter of record.
Right.
You know, this same...
No, I've heard that before, too.
Right.
Yeah.
This whole talking about, you know, how does this telluric energy ley line factor into it? And we go into this in the book. This leads us to what was the next little unexpected discovery related to this mystery that, you know, kind of took me by surprise. And it requires a little, just a tad background.
As much as you want to give.
And because the case had gone that direction, in the esoteric direction, and towards the occult, and towards the ley lines, I had begun to refer to the ley line maps that were created for me relating to my Disneyland research. Now, I had received in February of 2008 some maps from Sacheri, the author, who has been, you know, working with geomorphology and developing his theory of ley lines and geomorphology, his particular theory, he'd been working on it for 25 years.
Right.
And he prepared these maps and sent them to me in February of 2008, very specifically on February 11th. I looked at the date of the package. Now, it was in 2009 when I was neck deep in the research for this, and Rick was already involved, and we were working together on it, that it just so happened that what came up in the greater Inland Empire research I was doing was the murder of Sherry Jo Bates, one of the Zodiac victims.
Who okay, was I was going to bring it up, but Walter has done a very nice segue.
Who was murdered on October 30th, 1965, in downtown Riverside, which is kind of San Bernardino's sister city. And
basically right next door to it.
Right. And so I thought, well, isn't this interesting? I pulled out the map, and I was astonished. Again, these were maps that I'd had for a year, and there was Sherry Jo Bates' murder site right there on one of these alleged ley lines that Sesheria had identified for us. So then I pulled out my other maps, and I took...
Of the San Francisco Bay Area?
Of California.
Oh, okay.
And I plotted the Zodiac, the known Zodiac attack sites, and what I found was that every single Zodiac killer attack site was on one of these ley lines. The hair rose up on my arms and the back of my neck because, again, I'd had these ley line maps handmade by Sesheria. I'd had them in my possession for a year. This was not a theory and then we matched maps or anything. No, no, no. I had these maps, and there it was. Lake Berryessa Vallejo, Paul Stein over the Presidio, and it was spooky, to be honest. And, you know, if nothing else, there is a chapter on the Zodiac Killer in the book, and the book goes into why there is a Zodiac association with the San Bernardino killings, and it has to do with Hecate and the ley lines. But I was convinced as an investigator, I am convinced that Zodiac was doing what the possible perpetrator or perpetrators in 1915 were doing, and that was committing human sacrifice in association with the ley energy of the earth, the telluric currents. Now, you don't have to believe this. Rick or I don't have to believe in this stuff being true. What we're arguing is the killer likely or very possibly believed this. And I would argue that the Zodiac Killer, if you look closer, if you were to follow and look at the towns along these lines, and there's unsolved murder cases, unsolved homicides or missing person cases during the Zodiacs, you know, the 60s and 70s or whatever around there, I don't know, you might be able to attribute more to the Zodiac Killer. And you have to remember, the Zodiac himself told the police that there were at least 37 more bodies in Southern California.
In one of his letters. But did he ever mention any... The only occult thing I can ever remember him mentioning in any of his notes was he was gathering slaves for his afterlife or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the only real... Mm-hmm. And then the fact... I think... Didn't somebody finally crack the code and it really didn't tell anybody? It was, I think a couple somewhere cracked that code.
There's been various codes cracked and such, but you have to look at the whole case. You have to really dig into it and to see why they suspect that he had an occult knowledge and awareness.
Well, here's a question. Have you, for instance, maybe the Zebra Killers or something like that, or any other serial killer plotted their murders? The Hillside Strangler, whatever, Richard Ramirez, plotted them and see what happens?
No, we haven't done that.
So, because they're...
No, that would be an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, you could be totally surprised that either nothing matches up or some... It would just be an interesting exercise,
I think. Right. Oh, absolutely. For me, I was astonished enough that, you know, that's one hell of a coincidence if you want to accept coincidence.
Yeah. And if they do all match up, you know, what does that tell you? It tells you something, maybe even something different.
Now, remember, the known... There's more with the Zodiac Killer, and the book goes into it, but the known... ones that they usually talk about are the seven, you know, people that were attacked in the Bay Area. But before that, of course, there was Sherry Jo Bates, and before her, there was the couple at Gaviota State Beach down by Point Conception, also right on a ley line. So Sherry Jo Bates, the Gaviota Beach attacks, and the Bay Area attacks. Very disturbing in its implications.
The Zodiac angle is one of those that... You know, there are some creepy parallels. I don't know how compelling they are, And I think that, that makes them worth it, at least considering in that case. But with or without those creepy parallels between the two, I'd want to emphasize again, you still have the basic mystery.
Exactly.
You still have Cora Stanton. You still have the dead kids. You still have the mummified guy who's found in the desert who's missing for months and no one notices. These are all things that, in trying to cast, a wide net of possible connections in what these type of things may mean, the basic, certainly, case they're putting forward here is dependent upon those two things. And that's not really what the book is about. We're not really trying to establish a link between the two, but to suggest, sort of scratch our heads in a way and go, you know, there are some creepy parallels here. This may be, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, at the end of this, I think maybe the thing that, to use a term, that sort of haunts me to a degree about this whole case is really how localized was it? And I think this is something that, that might have been mentioned earlier on in the interview, that was this just something that was, you know, was it just a bunch of weird cultists or not a bunch of weird cultists or whatever it was who were doing these things and around San Bernardino and Southern California in 1915 and that's all there is to it? Or is this just a glimpse? Has a veil been lifted on something which is much more widespread, which is not part of something which is localized, but which is spread much further than that? You know, I mean, here's where people who, I don't know if you want to, start looking, use this as a basis to begin investigating various odd things in your own town.
Right.
It actually got me, I grew up in a town in Central California, which was probably about the same size as San Bernardino was, I didn't go up to 1915, but around at that time. And it actually got me thinking of some things that I could remember my parents mentioning or something that I could hear them or other adults whispering about. I mean, some of these were murder cases or something charged with, some sort of illicit sexuality in it and what people were doing. And I began to wonder, there's certainly nothing exactly paralleling this, but there were some dark little episodes that took place in the history of my hometown, and I suspect in almost any human habitation of one size or another, you have the same things. So what we're looking at here is a kind of freaky set of coincidences or localized crime, or is it something more? And that's the question I really come away with.
Well, and also, that leads to, let's look at one of the other victims here. The first victim in this mystery we identify as a man who was named O.H. Bailey. Now, he was found, the day after Cora Stanton was found, but he was this mummified man that Rick referred to. He was found on his knees with one hand over his mouth and the other hand, allegedly his gun hand, off to the side and the gun there. And his skin was so dried from being out in the elements that they described him as being mummified. He was beyond physical description. However, he was
strange. No animals try to eat him.
That too. And he was wearing a suit with his Masonic pin on the lapel. And of course, he had his wallet and his ID, and that's how they knew that this corpse was O.H. Bailey.
Somebody planted the wallet.
Well, in the book goes into all that. We considered that. The book goes into it.
Okay.
But what was interesting was he had been living in a boarding house, and he had not been seen for 3 months, okay, when they found his remains. And when they finally opened his room, they found all his Masonic regalia laid out on the bed. He was a local, Blue Lodge Freemason. He was also a member of the local Knights Templar fraternity.
Templar. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting is they probably figured he died around mid-August.
Which would make him sort of the first one?
He was the first one. And mid-August was one of the days of veneration of Hecate, the ancient goddess. And so
why is that important?
He's the first one. And then the next one is a gentleman by the name of Isidore Jussot, who is a local trapper and hunter, and he's known. He's kind of a guide in the mountains and stuff. And his is the only one that... It was deemed an accident. He died in a boating accident on Baldwin Lake, which then had water in it. It's bone dry now. And what makes it interesting to our mystery is he drowned, and Cora Stanton would later drown. And, of course, our geomorphology guy, source, identified one of these ley lines going through this Baldwin Lake. And then, of course, the next thing to happen are the Estep children are poisoned. The little girl dies. And then a few days later, Cora Stanton is found dead in the lake. And then, like, within a day, the boy, the Estep boy, dies from the poisoning.
Right.
And then on December 2nd, 14-year-old Orta Hedges dies from eating the poison orange. And then on December 10th, you have a gentleman by the name of E. Percival Braid, who is a real estate... an estate planner. He's a law student, and he's very well regarded. And he is British-born. And he, Percival Braid, this is very active in the British war relief effort. And he has found, allegedly has shot himself in the head, in bed, in the house he's living in.
And also shot himself with a gun that somehow, someone else had shot themselves
right.
with, that had been stolen from the evidence locker.
Exactly. That summer, another suicide had shot himself, and Braid, you know, this was the gun that they found, you know, in his hand that he allegedly shot himself with. Now, to go back to O.H. Bailey, O.H. Bailey, here's an interesting little thing, and the book goes into this in greater detail than I'm going to go into here, but the record, they can't decide where this guy was found, because... The newspapers say one thing. The coroner's report record that I got a copy of says two others, and another newspaper says yet another.
So you had access to the coroner's report, just not the police reports.
Right. Right. Well, what little there is, believe me, it's a few words on one sheet. But
right.
Here's the interesting thing. The most interesting place that it was identified as the place where his body was found was within 80 feet or 80 yards. It was 80 yards, I believe, below the giant arrowhead. Now, for those of you not familiar with San Bernardino, there is a large arrowhead of like 400 feet long, 300 feet wide.
It is a rock that looks very almost exactly like an arrowhead on an Indian an Indian arrowhead, and this is what I believe Lake Arrowhead is named after.
Well, yes, and anything arrowhead in the area is named after. It's been there for many, many years. It was there when
it's what most
the
people would call
arrived.
A simulacra.
Exactly. Or some people think it's even an older megalithic thing, but
right.
we, you know.
That's why I said most people.
Yeah. Now, here's what's interesting. The arrowhead is oriented to magnetic north, and when you follow where the arrow point leads to, across San Bernardino Valley, over into Riverside, it points to the heart of the lay telluric energy configuration that our guy Secheria has identified as being in Riverside. The arrowhead, if you plot out the line across the valley, goes down into Riverside. It points to the exact spot where there is a monument to two police officers, also an unsolved crime from the early 70s. Okay, murdered, all right, ambushed, and off of that, the line goes right through the alley where Sherry Jo Bates was murdered by the Zodiac Killer. So there you have O.H. Bailey, found dead just below that arrowhead in 1915, and you've got that arrowhead oriented to magnetic north. Now, what's interesting is a researcher named Michael F. Cole has done some great research on the Zodiac Killer, and when he talked about the radians and his stuff
right,
with the maps.
Right.
And magnetic north plays an important part in the lore of the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah, not true north, but magnetic north.
Magnetic north.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is we would argue the book suggests that, you know, because it's known that the Zodiac Killer had an Inland Empire Association, probably lived there for a while.
Right.
You know, again, there's a connection. What did the Zodiac know about these San Bernardino killings?
The question I had when you said all the stuff in the Bay Area matched up with the Zodiac on all the lines, and
right.
there's not a whole mess of these lines that Sesh has drawn out.
Right.
However, what you assured me is he had no idea where the Zodiac Killer's victims were. That was not even in his mind.
No, he did these maps for me for another reason entirely, and these maps were given to me, a year, more than a year before I I made the discovery about the Zodiac Association on the ley lines. But we're talking bar none. Every one of the known Zodiac attacks and murder sites are on these ley lines. And that, as an investigator, I can't ignore that. I have to say, okay, what was he thinking? What was Zodiac thinking? None of us have to believe in this ley energy.
But Sesh came up with those by looking at his maps using his method.
His method is geomorphology, which is the study of how the terrain is formed, and reading the topographical maps. He does everything according to how the terrain, the physical terrain flows.
He's the first person I've heard that does that, though.
Oh, no. Geomorphology is a... Okay.
Whoever the Zodiac was would have access to these methods and be able to draw the same maps or have access to them or whatever.
That's the suggestion, is that, he was plotting these murders as sacrifices, of course, to get slaves, and tapping into, believing that if he tapped into the telluric currents, this is the suggestion.
So this is
what's implied.
So the basic idea here is, well, there's a few of them, but one of the basic ideas is there was some sort of group in San Bernardino at the time who were involved with or engineering killings of people for some nefarious purpose.
That is what...
And they may or may not have been involved with German elements who are also occultists.
That is one possibility here. That's one possibility. It could also have been you just had a lone psychopath doing this.
Right.
And
at one point we were thinking that it might have been the Zodiac at that point, but he would have had to have been like...
Yeah, Zodiac would have been a kid when 1915, but it could have been a tradition passed on if a group, and that gets pretty dark and nefarious there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the idea that this isn't something which is just localized. You ask about, again, Walter could probably add more on this, as to whether or not there was someone in the San Bernardino area around 1915 who would have known about telluric currents and might have been interested, and that there was, and he's discussed quite a bit in the book, and that's Orlis Kennedy.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And Orlis Kennedy is, hunted down oil deposits, well known for doing that, had a very knowledgeable, Walter, he liked to read the earth.
Yeah, he actually could predict earthquakes.
Predict earthquakes.
By reading the terrain, and he was well known for it. It was mentioned in articles about him at the time.
Yeah, made quite a fortune in terms of finding oil for people, although he was, his two other things besides and finding oil deposits was that he was an avowed socialist and the head of the first spiritualist church in San Bernardino, and the fellow who sort of helped set up a memorial service to this unknown woman, Cora Stanton.
Right. That's what brings us back to the suspicion of the spiritualists, was the fact that Cora seemed to be so important to the spiritualist temple, and as Rick was saying,
they were the only people that decided it was their job to give a memorial service to this unknown woman.
Well, no. Here's the interesting thing: the spiritualist temple gave a very special service two nights before Cora's funeral, in which Orlis Kennedy spoke. He gave an address about Cora Stanton, and she was very important to the spiritualist temple. Now, what's interesting is
he talked about this woman to a congregation before she was killed.
No. The 2 days before her funeral.
Oh, funeral. Okay, I'm sorry.
No.
She was on ice for quite a while.
Yeah. Now, 2 days later, she has a funeral, which is officiated over by Walter Franklin Prince, the man who would go on in the next decade to kind of get into a battle with corrupt spiritualists, with him and Harry Houdini. I want to throw in there, the book explains that during this mystery in November 1915, Harry Houdini was performing in Los Angeles.
Of course.
Okay, so Houdini was in the area, and me, I suspect, we have to ask the question, were Prince and Houdini already kind of communicating and working together against these spiritualists before the Boston.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know when he started his.
Well, that's the question is an.
It was
possible?
After his mother died, actually, right?
That was when he really turned up the heat. Yeah, because that's what ruined his relationship with Arthur Conan Doyle and such.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, at the time Prince was in San Bernardino as the rector of St. John's Episcopal Church, he was already writing and working for James Hervey Hyslop, the head of the ASPR.
Oh, okay.
Before him. So you have a guy who was instrumental heading up a team against corrupt spiritualists in the following decade, who is the local Episcopalian rector in San Bernardino during this mystery, and there's a very active spiritualist temple. It makes me wonder, you know, hey, did what happened in San Bernardino inspire Prince to really turn up the heat and go after these spiritualists with Houdini? And he's the one who officiates over Cora Stanton's funeral. So
Kennedy was, or
no, Prince, Walter Franklin Prince. So Kennedy and the spiritualists did their big shindig for her two nights before. But then Prince,
there are two of them.
Yeah, okay. and Prince, he officiates at her funeral, so she was important to him for a reason too. And,
right.
And this is just a glimpse into the weirdness with all this,
yeah.
And why this woman, and then the book also gets into kind of etymological things. The name Cora Stanton. There's many reasons to think that this might have been just a BS identity,
yeah.
But one of them.
Where did that name come from?
It came from the suicide note.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, what's interesting is the book gets into this, and I'll leave it to people to read the book, but I'll throw this tidbit out there.
Yeah.
When you read the book, you see that the name Cora Stanton in itself has some esoteric levels to it. The name Cora is also another name for Persephone, the famous goddess of the underworld.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Stanton means the place of the standing stones, and it also means like a memorial of ancestors, that kind of thing. Well, what is a memorial to ancestors with standing stones but a cemetery? So it implies, you know, you've got Cora or Persephone of the underworld, and last name also refers to a cemetery. So there you have symbolism going on there. And who was it that went into the underworld to bring Persephone / Cora back but Hecate? And we haven't even begun to scratch the surface on Hecate's involvement here tonight, but the book really explains what Hecate's role might have been in this, and what her role is definitely in the symbolism of what's going on, and also the, you know, some of the other little discoveries that are made along the way.
Okay, given it, and we've got 20 minutes, we got plenty of time, but and if I've missed something that you wanted to discuss, please tell me. We could.
Well, I'll throw out one more little.
Oh, go ahead.
More little piece of weirdness of coincidence.
Because I'd one more kind of basic question, but go right ahead.
Okay. We mentioned before that the in terms of the Cora Stanton identity, there's this mysterious figure who calls himself Thomas Cavanaugh, who pops up, proclaims that he knows her family, can't identify the body, and then vanishes. The information he gives about himself proves to be bogus. He's there and he's not there. Now, I'm just trying to hunt, you know, Thomas Cavanaugh is that we found several. One later found a Thomas Cavanaugh who was an inmate of a local insane asylum, but I ran across one of those things. I came across more or less as much by accident as anything else, or by serendipity. About 2 years later, in 1917, a Thomas Cavanaugh is found in New Mexico, drowned in a lake. The circumstances as to how he got there, now apparently he's related to some people in a small town nearby, but no one can explain how he managed to get miles out of town and was drowned in the lake, especially because he was by then blind.
Huh.
So there may be absolutely no connection between those two things.
But it's
another very strange little factoid that works its way in.
Yeah, when you start looking at these things, they start looking back at you. There's a well-known Well, that's well known too. But there's a well known phenomenon in UFO and Fortean and maybe even cryptozoological lore with names. And I did a little research on names of people who had seen UFOs in Southern California, based on a very strange sighting of something getting out of a something on the beach and talking, allegedly talking to a witness in, I think, 1958 or 57. And somebody with the same name was also involved in a sighting of a day later, about 10 miles south, just somebody out of their house, completely unrelated, same last name. And then I believe they also had the same last name as the person that saw the Riverside Bridge Monster a year before that. And I can't remember the name. It's a very Wetzel, I believe. And then it connected in with my research because a letter that was sent to the Air Force Office of Special Investigation to lure UFO researchers in was supposedly sent by a witness named Craig Wetzel. And that's the same name as the guy that had seen the UFO in 1957. It just gets weirder and weirder.
Yeah, the nature of...
And I don't know why that is. There might be something going on with the name that attracts strangeness.
Well, this is very much one of those mysteries where you pull a thread and you go, it leads you down the rabbit hole. You know, there's strangeness in the research that did not end up in the book.
Right. You know, that happened with some of the stuff I've done, too. It's like, I am not going to put this in the book because people are going to go, what?
Yeah, and because, you know, Rick and I, we want, primarily, it is a true crime book. Aside from all the ooh, ah, the fun weirdness, let's remember that, you know, as my hunch as a experienced investigator is that there was definitely murder, 99% definitely murder in the cases of the children. I mean, those weren't suicides. And the police at the time, you know, said it didn't appear to be any kind of accident. They were given this stuff. So if we're talking murder here, that's the foremost thing, that there would be someone arrogant enough and, you know, crazy enough to be doing this kind of thing for whatever, you know, the occult reasons. It's primarily, you know, a true crime situation.
Okay, given that, I've got two sort of questions that we can chew on till the end of the show, and one of them is, given what you've told me and this admittedly slightly ephemeral nature of what you've discovered compared to what most people would think a true crime story would be, this is a completely different twist on it that it hasn't been heard of before, where you follow these things and speculate basically on the deep convictions and belief systems of the people that may have been the perpetrators, people, persons, whoever. And the second one is, and maybe I'll repeat it later, who would be interested in the book? Because I know I am. I know people listening to this show would be. And why? But the first question it sounds like you've done something different, both you and Richard, and how you did the research on this book and this strange episode, which admittedly is weird. There shouldn't be that many people dying, and the steps you took from that.
Primarily, again, anyone interested in true crime books where it is the weirder aspects, not the clear, you know, they know who did it, they know exactly what happened. If you're interested in missing persons type or unsolved cases particularly, but also if you're interested in the occult and esoterica, you'll find the book interesting. If you're interested in, you know, intelligence and espionage history. You know, these are the obvious. But if you're interested in synchronicities, if synchronicity kind of turns you on and gets your attention, I because we haven't begun to.
How many crimes have been solved by following the synchronicities? Probably more than you would care to. Most people would care to think.
More than investigators would care to admit. But
admit, yes, exactly.
You know, absolutely. But it's. As you can tell, I mean, it's wow. Those who are used to me being on the show, you can tell I'm at a loss for words. That's what this mystery has done to me, done for me, is I thank God, you know, there's Rick here to describe this whole thing to you better than me. Because
in most true crime situations, the crime itself is relatively apparent. It's obvious. So you've got a murder. I don't know. Let's pick something out of, you know. Marilyn
Manson.
Monroe is dead. Okay. and then it becomes a question as to who would kill her and why, that type of thing. The crime, the existence of the crime itself is usually not a matter of the investigation.
Right.
So really where we begin here is that we're really most of the time we're doing is reconstructing the crime itself, which I don't think in its time was ever recognized as such. And you had these poisonings of these two very young children and sort of pre-adolescent girl, and you know, those were sort of recognized as homicides, but nothing's really done about it. It's like, well, somebody poisoned these kids. We don't know what they poisoned them with. We don't know who poisoned them. And then it just dropped.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's like they never existed. What appears, and I think, what is pretty clearly a disguised homicide, and not that well disguised murder, that of Cora Stanton, and all of the things that go with it, that is dismissed as a suicide. I mean, it's the Bailey case, you know, of why this man is literally missing for months, and people who claim to know him just aren't concerned about that, and you know, have not even bothered to check into this. Part of it is taking these disparate things, which individually might appear to be entirely. I mean, if you ran across the Orta Hedges case, where young girl, it's poison orange, dies, you know, that wouldn't raise too much concern. If you looked at the Estep children separately, it's only when you begin to group them together, and you take them and you begin to position them in time and place, that the relationship begins to emerge. Yeah. And it may be, I mean, I'd certainly be willing to say that if everything was revealed, not all of these seven cases may be related. Braid's suicide may be nothing more than a suicide. It could be unrelated to them. But when you put all of these things in time and place, certainly I think most of them are. Even if you stripped everything else away from it and all you had was the Cora Stanton case, you've still got one hell of a mystery.
Right.
You have a murder. So part of what we're doing here is you're simply revealing, I think in the case of the Stanton case, we're recovering from a completely unjustified and peremptory and odd judgment of a suicide before there was any real investigation, a murder which it seems in many ways nobody particularly wanted to talk about until after the woman was dead, and then everybody wanted to talk about her. And then also connecting that to this other rash of equally unusual, unexplained deaths. So that's part of what this is about. Can we name a killer in each one of these cases? No, because I don't think there is one killer. But what we're doing is revealing the crime itself. And that's where I think the main difference with perhaps the usual approach would be.
Well, as Rick, you answered the question in the way that I wanted to ask it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, what I'm saying. I'm glad Rick's here because my head might be spinning because I was, you know, physically close to all this and been thinking about it for 3 years and analyzing it and writing, and it's just I have to admit I've been at an uncharacteristic loss of words. But you know, I know there's only a few minutes left, but you want to throw out the possibility of anyone wants to call in that time?
Well, we could ask if anybody wants to call 213-252-0998 to talk to Richard Spence and Walter Bosley here. About their new book, we've been talking about for the last 2 hours.
And I'll remind everybody, it's available at Amazon.com.
Empire of the Wheel.
Empire of the Wheel, Espionage, the Occult, and Murder in Southern California. And as I said, it's available at Amazon.com as a Kindle book right now. Remember, if you don't have a Kindle device, you can get the software for free from Amazon so that you can still read Kindle books. Also, our contributing editor, Scott Moody, as I mentioned earlier, he's going to be putting together a special edition, printed edition of this book, along the lines of the fantastic volume he did for Adam Gorightly's Shadow Over Santa Susana, the premium hardcover that just, and I know you've seen it when Adam was speaking. It's a beautiful book. And Scott, this is his.
I got mine.
You know, not only is he, you know, was our contributing editor to this thing, and but also he's a bibliophile, and he does this. He designs books. So we're really looking forward to when.
Well, yeah, he saw the first draft and started asking the first questions, and then a few of the other people you showed to, like myself, we were asking questions as well, right. And some of that has been revised based on some of our questions, and could you clear this up, and et cetera. But the point is. The point is that I realized after reading and talking to Walter, Richard and Walter here, is that you're not reading the book to get an answer. You're reading a book to make your brain work, to make you realize, like you said at the beginning, Richard, that things are not always as they seem. In fact, they're often not as they seem. And to look at this almost century-old crime or any weird, you know, unsolved thing in maybe a little different light, and maybe not just, you know, who wanted whose money, or, you know, whose wife was jealous of whoever, because that doesn't really apply here, I don't think. And there are different motivations for these unexplained deaths than the authorities at the time would have you believe, which in fact was nothing. They didn't really seem to really care. They would just get their pat answer and then walk on.
And there's some theoretical gems in the book that we will not discuss here tonight. Of course, there's no time, but I really recommend you read the book, because we've just, you know, kind of scratched the surface of the weirdness and the possibilities.
Uh-oh, there's a dog barking somewhere.
Yes, that's here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you've been listening to all the sirens going by here, and that's par for the course. Richard, is there anything you also wanted to add before we sign off here?
Anything I wanted to add? No, I think I'm okay.
Anything that I should have asked that you wish I had asked? Because you comported yourself very well with all these questions. I mean, like I said, you answered questions that I did not put quite right, and I appreciate that.
Anyway, I just echo Walter's comments about I think who would be interested in the book. I think anybody who likes to. Oh. Who likes a good mystery would enjoy this, and one that's going to, you know, give them something to think about. You know, they may find things in it they'll shake their head about. They may find things that some of the answers that sound right, some of them sound wrong. They can come up with ones of their own. Maybe there's somebody else out there who can put all of this together. But I do think it's a book that will make you think, maybe even, you know, disturb it. There are some aspects of it that are disturbing, but in its own way, like the best of things, enlightening.
I do have one question I thought of just as you were saying that. Both of you, this question, doing this book, and I know when I write, every time I finish something, because it involves intense concentration and research and all that, what changed in you? Did it change your ideas about anything? Did it, you know... What happened to you coming out the other end of the experience of writing this thing, doing the research and getting the book done?
You go first, Rick.
Okay. What changed?
Yeah, did it change you? Did you stare into it? Did it change
you? Possible. The world is even a more interesting and stranger place than I thought it was before.
Well, that's always wonderful.
I learned a new appreciation for what was mentioned before in terms of synchronicity. Which is one of those things that, you know, I have to admit, when I first heard that term or had it explained to me years ago, it was one of those things I thought was just kind of dumb. I didn't know what people were talking about, and I have learned quite often, painfully, exactly what synchronicity is, but also how, in some cases, scary, but wondrous it can be. And there's an awful, I mean, as Walter said, there are things that didn't make it into the book. I mean, there are whole sections that just, you know, because it often contains stuff that was interesting, but ultimately sort of a topic in and of itself. And I suppose that's something that there always was kind of a struggle to do, was to keep things on, you know, to keep the mystery itself at the center of this. So yes, it's given me a new appreciation of the presence and power of synchronicity in human affairs.
And you know, for me, it would take a show in itself to describe what changed for me or what I, on a personal level, got out of it. I'll just say this, that old phrase that when you look into the abyss, something looks back, I definitely learned that. I have new respect for that.
Was something looking back at you or just the weirdness of the story?
That's for another that's okay. Another conversation. And I also came away with a greater respect for two other players that just because I learned more about them. And that's Aleister Crowley and Hecate herself.
We did get one question from a listener, from Mike Cleland, our friend Mike in Idaho, actually. He said, could the events along the ley lines be based not on any occult knowledge of the Zodiac Killer, or could the killer have been, and could the killer have been unconsciously influenced by the overt energies? Could he have been following some inner urge and not pre-planning with a line with map with lines drawn on them? I think we kind of suggested that.
Of course, that's wow. Okay, now that's getting into something. What we're asking is on what we were the flip side of what he's saying is it's a conscious act on the part of the perpetrator who believes something that may or may not be true, whereas this is you have to accept the reality of the lay energy. That's possible.
And somehow affecting this person and possessing them or whatever.
Yeah.
Or people.
That gets into what you personally believe about these concepts.
Well, see, the book is already doing what it's supposed to do.
Exactly.
All right, we're at 1 minute till the end of the show, so I will thank both of you, especially because Walter's here all the time, but Richard, for taking this 2 hours with us to talk about this book in such detail for the first time, and this will be posted up within a day or so at writingmysterioso.com. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, and glad to talk with you, and glad to talk with Walter again.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll be talking soon.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Good night.
All right, good night. Right.
Actually, I'll add on to what I said about how it changed me. As an investigator, I you ever watch the Law and Order with Vincent D'Onofrio?
I've seen a couple.
You know how strange his character is?
Yeah.
Okay, that's how I feel now as an investigator. As strange as Vincent D'Onofrio's character on the Law and Order show that he's on. That's what this has done for me.
Actually, you probably more remind me of Kyle MacLachlan in Twin Peaks after all this.
A little bit of that,
yeah.
Too.
You should be out there throwing rocks.
Because, as you know, this has been an intense part of my life for 3 years. And as Rick and I said, the weird stuff that went on is not in this book. It didn't need to be. That's why it's not. It didn't need to be, because what we have there, we feel, is the solid.
Right. It's like when somebody writes a song and they say, I went through all this. Like, you hear this big popular song and somebody will say, well, that's my feelings. And the thing is, it's like 1% of what they went through. It's what you can communicate to other people that will be interesting and understandable and they can use it. And that's where the art lies.
And another, going back to what you said, who will like this book, I left out one group. Clearly, fans of the Zodiac Killer mystery. There's one chapter on the Zodiac, but it is essential and it's a doozy. And so Zodiac Killer fans, get this book because there appears to be a possible thematic connection between the 1915 San Bernardino working murders, and you'll learn what the San Bernardino working is when you read the book, and between that and the Zodiac Killer murders, because, and I'm going to give you a little taste before I stop, Hecate, her name is associated with the number 100, and she is often venerated in two sets of 50. Now, the San Bernardino working murders occurred in 1915. Roughly 50 years later, the Zodiac emerges. We are coming upon the 100th anniversary of the San Bernardino working murders in 2015 and the 50th anniversary of the emergence of the Zodiac killer. Could this happen again? 1915, 50 years later, the Zodiac killer, and now 2015 is coming.
I was trying to find some, like, ragtime music from then. I don't even know if that was popular then. I guess they were moving out of ragtime and into something else in 1915. Ragtime is like 1890s, early 1900s.
Right. 1915 would have been the early... 1915, would that be the early days of jazz as we know it?
No. Jazz was being developed in Chicago and New Orleans as we know it, I believe. Maybe the from the teens up through the 20s, and by the probably the mid 20s, it was people like Duke Ellington had hooked on to it, and they were starting to develop it to what we now know as jazz.
What about Dixieland? Was that the missing link?
I suppose
was that going
so,
on between ragtime?
What would
and
they have been listening to?
Jazz?
What would they have been playing and
That's
listening
right.
to in a saloon in San Bernardino and in 1915?
And there were saloons in San Bernardino and a rootin' tootin' red light district too in 1915.
How about Maple Leaf Rag? That's very easy. It's Scott Joplin. We know everybody knew that song back then, and we're playing it. Once again, before we go, the name of the book is, Walter? Turn that down.
Sorry. Empire of the Wheel, Espionage, the Occult, and Murder in Southern California. Available at Amazon.com.
And that is it only in...
It's only in Kindle, $6.99, a great price.
Right.
It is, but remember, you can get the Kindle program for free. You do not have to have a Kindle device. You can download the Kindle software program onto your PC, your laptop, your Mac, your smartphone, your iPad, whatever your preference is, for free. Amazon gives it away so that you, too, can purchase and read Kindle books. Empire of the Wheel... by Walter Bosley and Richard B. Spence.
All right, thanks. And then now I found Maple Leaf Rag actually played by Scott Joplin, apparently. That's not played by Scott Joplin. Oh, you know what it is? It's a piano roll, probably. It's a piano roll recorded as a piano roll with him playing his own composition. So this is how it's supposed to sound.
Cool.
So you're walking into a saloon in San Bernardino in 1915. You may have heard this.
Might
this
have.
Actual piano roll, too.
I'd love to go back.
I went through a mania of Scott Joplin when I was about 12 years old.
Really?
I think when did the Sting come out?
1974.
Okay, so I was 12. Or, no, 11. I was 11. And I was taking piano at the time. Mm-hmm. I learned how to play The Entertainer. It was fucking tough. My fingers could barely reach the octave it required to play the... And I had the original sheet music. It was really complicated. I mean, for a good pianist, it wasn't at all. But to me, it was like both hands were doing completely different things. It was beautiful.
That's impressive that you learned that, that you went through that at 12.
I really wanted to play it because I really liked the sound of it. I still do.
It is awesome. It's good stuff.
I mean, I still know all these songs by heart. I mean, I know...
I could sit here and just listen. I don't know. Maybe you might inspire a ragtime jaunt of mine for a while.
Yeah, I checked out the complete ragtime piano compositions of Scott Joplin from the local library. It was like four or five vinyl records, and I listened to all of them multiple times. There was something wrong with me. I don't know.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But the funny thing is I also had a Kiss and an Elton John record at the same time, as I remember.
Oh, there you go.
So
there you go. No, this music, you know, makes me think of one of my favorite eras is that, you know, the turn of that century, in the 19th into the 20th, you know, before World War One, and, you know, the late 1870s into 1900. I just love that era. I really enjoyed when I wrote the novel, which was inspired by Empire of the Wheel events, the novel called titled I Will See You in Time, for those interested, also at Amazon. It just allowed me to, just in a creative way, jump into, you know, the early... there's a part of the book that goes to 1906 in San Francisco.
And this actually might be something that actually was heard. It's Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah, it sounds like it's an old enough...
This probably wasn't recorded in 1915. I don't know what the... you know what is interesting? Is I have a record, a CD, where they have piano rolls recorded by Jelly Roll Morton of his own compositions.
Mm-hmm.
But they've taken the piano rolls, they take the data off them, they create a MIDI stream with it to control a musical instrument, mm-hmm. and then they hook it up to this like Steinway grand piano.
Right.
And so basically it's like having Jelly Roll Morton playing live on a Steinway grand piano based on his piano rolls, which it didn't... The only problem with the piano rolls, it didn't tell you how hard you were supposed to hit the keys, how much volume for forte right. you needed. So they used recordings, and then they programmed that into the music. So they used recordings of him actually playing the compositions... Or they went to the original music if he had written it down and notated where he said to hit the keys harder or softer or whatever and program that into the piano as well.
That's impressive.
So the guy said, I did all this and then I watched the piano. It's like watching the ghost of Jelly Roll Morton playing the piano. You didn't see anything. All you see the keys was moving.
And, of course, the player piano led... Hedy Lamarr to create the basic system for radio-controlled torpedoes.
Oh, that's right. All of this talking about 1915, now I'm all suddenly interested to hear that music. But we will not stay here all night. Do you want to go for pie or do you need to go?
I don't. You're the old married guy.
I'm still not working, people.
I'm the night thankfully. Owl. I'm the crazy night owl who stays up thinking about things like the murder of Cora Stanton. The red-haired virgin, 35-year-old virgin. So sexual assault was not the aim. Robbery, maybe, but there was cash, you know, I think a few dollars or whatever in her purse. Why not take that, too? Yeah, it's been... an interesting 3 years.
All right, Walter. Well, thanks for coming on. You did more publicity than I did, which is why I kind of held off on it. We had more listeners today than we've had in a few weeks, and I'm sure there'll be a lot in the on the podcast. That goes out probably within the next 24 to 48 hours. It will appear in whoever's... subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, or you can just go to the site and download it and or listen to it. So we'll see you next week from 8 to 10 p.m. Walter may or may not be here, but I certainly will be. And either playing music or talking to somebody. We'll see who I can pick up this week, but I will announce it, like I said, on Twitter. Got to be on to Twitter. See you later.